You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the the evening of the 5th of April 2025. This is part two. The first one was Cracks in the Soviet Monolith. This is the end of the Soviet Monolith. I said last week, I was a young teenage student in college when a lot of this stuff was going on. Now knowing it from a Russian point of view shows some of the falsity, because I was getting the New York Times every day back then, of how they were interpreting events. One of the inspirations for this two-part series is an essay by Solzhenitsyn, which was written between 1969 and 1973, as Breathing and Consciousness Return. He's talking about the liberalization that was occurring within the USSR, and this was from the collection From Under the Rubble. One of my favorite quotes from that goes like this: "Incomplete liberation from modest dogmas imposed by others is always punished by intermittent failures of vision and overhasty formulations." I guess back in the 60s, they still used words like modish. They were fashionable. There's a general consensus as to how this completely unprecedented event occurred. The collapse of a large empire in peacetime, and economic conditions and struggles, no different, although of course they have very different causes, the U.S. today. Everyone has their favorite thing to emphasize. There's a nationalism angle, there's a religious angle, there's the Reagan angle. But what Solzhenitsyn is saying here, and he says it throughout this and then later collections, that, of course, in the Soviet case, the dogma has been imposed by others, aliens, that, as he was writing those lines, was beginning to collapse. In the 70s, it was a radical shift took place in the 70s in the USSR. Last week, we talked about the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. The Jewish question is always front and center. The only time the U.S. put sanctions on the Soviet Union was for the Jews, to allow them to immigrate to Israel. And one of the reasons the Jews were leaving, because the system was no longer profitable. They weren't getting anything out of it. The U.S. was growing light years ahead of the Soviets, especially in high-tech industries. And they thought it was just a matter of time before the system collapses. The danger that Solzhenitsyn saw is that if the system collapses, and he knew it would relatively soon, what's going to replace the dogmas imposed by others? This make-believe, romanticized Leninism. And the way that the especially Jewish American academics at Harvard, it's amazing none of these people ever lose their jobs. Now, of course, they had their own self-interest involved here, but at least in their public pronouncements, it was something called freedom or democracy, which is not a goal. It's simply a means, at least in the normal sense of the term. In other words, they thought it would create a vacuum that nothing would fill. Well, of course, something did fill it, and that was the oligarchs that were almost exclusively Jewish. And that has a lot to do, at least near the end of the Carter administration, in the beginning of the Reagan administration, that the U.S. returned to a confrontational posture with the USSR. The aged Politburo, ideological inertia, and the internal socioeconomic problems of the USSR, it made them incapable of defense. Afghanistan, of course, was front and center. They were thrust in a terrible situation. Either they lose everything they invested in this country, or they invade it. And that was often the case in Eastern Europe as well. There was a wave of indignation against Soviet aggression there. Both Carter and Carter did put some sanctions on the Soviet Union and boycotted the Olympics in 1980. But when Reagan was elected, he declared war, the famous evil empire idea. I mean, he was correct as far as it goes. And he had a plan. Now, this was one of the times where the state and the regime started to split apart. The regime was condemning Reagan all over the place. How dare he oppose socialism? Consider now how they're so fanatical about destroying Russia under different circumstances. The CIA director, Casey, who was a banker before that, you remember Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, also a Jew. The point was to try to unite all the external and internal opponents of the USSR into one body under their control and to aggravate an already very difficult Soviet situation. Soviets, of course, were capturing, at this point, one country after another. Much of the Third World had already fallen. It was significantly ahead of NATO in terms of weaponry and armaments. But when the Israeli issue was brought in, now they're supporting terrorists all over the world. That is, supporting Iraq and Syria, and previously Egypt. They sent a South Korean passenger plane, which is strangely flight number 007, in 1983, where it was shot down. I have a whole exposition on that elsewhere. And an important part of the strategy was to encourage anti-Russian movements throughout the USSR and Eastern Europe, financed by the National Endowment for Democracy, which was run by a guy named Gershman at the time, and it itself was created in 1983. And the main front there was Poland and the Solidarity movement, both with the Vatican and the Mossad, who provided the agent network for this movement. Financing Solidarity continued until 1989, or at least the Solidarity was genuinely popular, but it was promoted and at least partially financed by the USA. The other thing, of course, supplying Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, starting roughly in 1985. Now the Soviets didn't have control over the skies. They had sabotage operations within the Soviet Central Asian republics in cooperation with China. And of course, drugs were one of the means whereby these were paid for. Afghans were growing opium poppies. And it's my view that the Taliban later on came into existence as a reaction to this. The weaponry was shipped via Pakistan. The drug trade income accounted for a quarter of its GDP at the time. Now, the economic situation was bad everywhere. The failing American economy in the late 70s and early 80s, interest rates went almost 20%, not to mention a reduction in oil prices and the devaluation of the dollar. The dollar still, oil purchases were done in dollars. Huge losses by the Soviet Union. This wasn't really a policy. That would have happened anyway. This was something you could take advantage of. Now, The U.S. was always trading, especially in high-tech and even offensive military technology, with the Soviet Union from day one. Reagan hated this idea, something McCarthy talked about. It's very hard to tell billionaires, especially arms traffickers, where they can make their money. But while it failed to a great extent, there were attempts to keep not just military technology, but also oil and pipeline technology, these advancements from going to the Soviets. And in the process, the intensification of the arms race, which, you know, at the time, this was really the reason, diverting a huge percentage of its GDP to the military. The what was called Star Wars, SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative. It was a psychological attack on the Soviet leadership that they can become invulnerable to a nuclear attack. And it did unnerve them, and it was successful. And it's almost, you know, I don't really have to say this, but the encouragement of Jewish immigration from the USSR, both Israel and the U.S., not just as a brain drain, which is negative, but a source of intelligence information. The Jewish issue, in addition to the anti-Russian mentality, was critical to this move of the new Reagan administration against the Soviet Union. Clearly, the economy was in trouble. It wasn't going anywhere. It was falling behind the way. This was an era of tremendous technical growth in the U.S. especially. Marxism was never the issue. I keep saying this, and I'll always say this. But a Russian empire that wouldn't let its Jews leave and go to Israel. And that was a huge deal at the time. And that started in the 1970s. Last week we talked about the development of a nuclear doctrine that specifically, you know, General Taylor targeted only Russian-speaking areas of the Soviet Union. The response to this was a book from Mikhail Gorbachev on what is now infamously perestroika or restructuring. And there's three issues. At this point, the Cold War had turned into a psychological war. Even those like Henry Kissinger was worried that sensible Soviet leaders are looking for a different economy and modern technology, not necessarily democracy. There was also the unwillingness of the population to live according to Marxist ideology. This is a new generation now in the 70s. The nomenklatura didn't accept this. This generation was born, they were babies at best during the revolution. They don't have that connection to it. And one of the key issues was the denigration, morally, of this very same nomenklatura, especially the middle-level bureaucracy. They wanted to join the civilized, universal human family. And this became a watchword for Gorbachev. Gorbachev was patronized primarily by Andropov. He even said he had a hand in my promotion. He said there was no person in the country's leadership with whom I was so closely and for so long connected, and to whom I was indebted for so much. So he was promoted by the former head of the KGB. And Gorbachev, in fact, relied on his cadres, his branching apparatus, and his own Andropov system began very similarly. He wanted to strengthen discipline and so-called modernize socialism. And of course, nothing really changed. The world economic situation was terrible, and foreign exchange earnings went down. The Soviets realized they were in trouble. What ended up happening, they wanted to establish domestic production of everything that had been bought abroad before. But in a high-tech age, central planning simply didn't work. In the 80s, economic growth of any kind stopped. In Gorbachev's mind, there was the liberation of labor and entrepreneurial initiative. This had to be unleashed, and it entailed the reform of the social system, but only in the confines of the party. And in that sense, he was very naive. In the last years of Brezhnev's life, the black market, the shadow economy, was increasingly dominant, especially in light industries, that is to say, consumer goods. State-run enterprises made products not appearing in their ledgers, selling them through state stores, of course, using double-entry bookkeeping. This was very common. In the southern part of the empire, all kinds of illegal workshops and factories developed. They had like semi-official sanction, and even some of the workers didn't realize that they were working for a private company. The 70s were a disaster for Soviets, especially psychologically. Theft at work, stealing things, that became not only standard, but praiseworthy. It was not considered a bad thing. In other words, the population didn't see the state as their own. In fact, it's a spontaneous form of resistance against this false dogmatic system. And the state really didn't have the means to suppress it. Like, for example, they went into an anti-alcohol campaign in 1985. They shut down a lot of vodka distilleries. And the only thing it really did was deprive the state budget of that income. But the Jews, both many who became oligarchs in the USSR, as well as many who created the Jewish organized crime in America, profited tremendously. There's any industry other than banking that's Jewish, it's distilling alcohol. There really was no possibility of improving the situation in the framework of a rotting Marxist ideology. Well, Gorbachev said he wants to take this rotting corpse and make it, quote, correspond to all the requirements of modernity. But when you don't have an ideology that connects people, and no alternative ideology that unites the nation, nothing can come from it. Solzhenitsyn's whole thing, as the Soviet Union began to weaken and fall, is what's going to replace it? There has to be something equally powerful that rules at least Russia. It can't be nothing, because that means the strongest, the most Machiavellian, will come to rule. And that's exactly what happened. There was no improvement in the economy. It gave freedom to its worst elements, but became known domestically and elsewhere as the so-called Russian Mafia, which was entirely Jewish. I strongly recommend Friedman's book, Red Mafia. It's a little out of date now, but it really set me straight on the question of Jewish organized crime, its origins in this era, and the fact that it is quite dominant in the U.S. The media calls it Russian. People like Michael Francis still call it Russian. They're not Russian. Many of the Italian families, such as they were, I think were completely dominated by the Jews. The Jews were far more powerful, had far more money, and there was very little, if any, enforcement against them. So perestroika, there was a flurry of new laws and regulations, which by itself creates chaos. It creates uncertainty. At the same time, it raises expectations, which is deadly. State enterprises started using Western accounting. The law on cooperatives in 1988, it didn't lead to any economic growth. They just legalized part of the shadow economy, giving local managers and directors and the Jewish mafia the right to open what they call cooperative production at state enterprises, use their fixed assets and raw materials, and pull the best personnel from them. And at the same time, cooperatives were subject to much lower taxes, maybe 3%, in order to encourage this market system, or what they thought was a market system. These cooperatives ended up being a form of money laundering. And further laws gave the director of state enterprises the right to dispose of production as if it were his own. There were many schemes by which this property could be legalized as private, through the merger of an enterprise with a shell company, for example, into a new entity, something called lease with the right of purchase. These are very Talmudic. This was a paradise of the Jews, because now, really in an almost state of lawlessness, they could create their own laws and interpret what existed in their own interests. In 1990, they allowed businesses, June of 1990, to incorporate. Nothing that came out of perestroika was anything but destructive. They didn't encourage production, but theft. The planned economy was destroyed, but the private economy was simply parasitic. It was a mafia-style oligarchy. If people didn't know it earlier, it was very clear that the Jews had abandoned the USSR, hated it, and began forming gangs both within and outside the Soviet Union. Friedman's book is excellent on how this came about. But all of these measures empowered the lowest elements in society, the most Machiavellian. They reduced tax revenues to the treasury, and then they started printing money. Enterprises were allowed to transfer part of their non-cash profits into cash rubles, of course, which was inflation, aggravated by a growing shortage of consumer goods. The coupon system was developed that just encouraged the black market. The population, of at least those who matter, really preferred the dollar. It used to be a one-to-one exchange rate. Not really exchange, because it was, the ruble didn't float. But the dollar in relation to the ruble was 67 kopecks to one. In 1991, it was 17 rubles to $1. Russian goods were cheap for foreign buyers, and it just contributed to their export and aggravated the shortage of goods and even more inflation. Worse, there was a partial abolition of the foreign trade monopoly starting in 87. These cooperative mafia organizations now could sell goods and raw materials abroad, everything from scrap metal to oil products. And then joint ventures with foreign firms were allowed, and in fact, they were given preferential terms. The export of 80% of the profits that they made in the Soviet Union abroad. Then they made it easier to travel abroad, not just for Jews this time. And I distinctly remember, late 80s, or very early 90s, the massive brain drain. The best Russian scientists and thinkers were leaving the country. And not just Jews either. Ultimately, his reforms, perestroika, glasnost, was really in practice just the legalization of everything that had been previously forbidden. Good things, bad things, healthy things, dangerous things. And given the nature of this now anarchic state, the most violent, the most devious, the most Judaic prevailed over healthy elements. And the party didn't really know how to distinguish one from the other. The Jewish oligarchy was already in formation. Thanks to the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, in the 70s, 40,000 Jews settled at Brighton Beach in Brooklyn. And a large cadre of that were former, gang members, mafia members, who then set up shop at the Odessa in Brooklyn. So, in March of 1987, one of my favorite writers of the era, Valentin Rasputin, talked about a spiritual restructuring. He was like Solzhenitsyn, he was aware that you can't just liberalize a system. There has to be authority, regardless of what you might call it. There has to be a goal. There has to be something to unify a population. He said he wants a spiritual restructuring to reject the half-dead ideology in which we were forced to live. And that's exactly what Solzhenitsyn was talking about in his 1969 essay. Alexander Yakovlev, one of Gorbachev's main ideologists, who was a consistent fighter against Russian nationalists, this is what he said in connection with the upcoming 1000th anniversary of the baptism of Rus. And these were the people who eventually came to dominate. Here's what he said. The departure of a number of our historians and writers from class assessments is a problem. But it is clear that the patriotism of Lenin, the noblest son of Russia, and the patriotism of, for example, Stolypin, are total opposites. To extol the church, the czars, the exploiting classes, cannot serve the cause of patriotic education. Any attempts to portray Christianity as the mother of Russian culture must be rejected. Gorbachev, in many quotes after his famous book on Perestroika came out, said he believed in the cosmos, this pantheistic universe. Well, without orthodoxy, there is no Russian culture. And of course, no one ever defines it outside of that. But if there is no Russian culture, there was no repression of it. He cannot, nor will people like that, ever say what this culture is otherwise. As they approach the 1000 anniversary of the baptism, he says, it's time to break the 1,000-year Russian paradigm of unfreedom. This is a powerful man, and this level of illiteracy and arrogance, there is no way to stop the country from sliding towards disaster, either by inaction, like Brezhnev, or even positive action, like Gorbachev. Gorbachev loved to be showered with awards. The praise of the West really became like a drug to him, and I'm not the only one who says this. Now, the National Bolsheviks, or the Red Patriots, really hate Gorbachev. He was a treacherous Masonic traitor to destroy the USSR. He had a plan to do it, and he carried it out, which is not really a profound idea. If somebody who actually had that agenda was placed in the position of general secretary, and he wanted to destroy the USSR, the only thing he had to do was just leave everything as it was. Everything that we talked about, probably since the beginning of my lectures on the radio in 2008, all of that, the collapse would have been unavoidable. And he certainly didn't want to lose power. And in the shameful way that he did. He did believe that he could carry out liberal reforms within the framework of socialism, or whatever he thought socialism was. Yakovlev was central, late 80s, early 90s, in Gorbachev's mentality. Yakovlev went so far as to even hate the red, white, and blue Russian flag. He said, the people of Russia, the October Revolution, which created its own flag, spoke out against the flag and the system it represented. I'll defend this Soviet flag, just as my father defended it for 4 years during the Civil War, just as I defended it myself during the Great Patriotic War. Really, the only way that those who ran Perestroika could maintain their power was some loyalty to the October Revolution. If they rejected it as false, why would anyone listen to them? These men who served this false ideology for so long, they should remain in power? In 1997, you know, long after these events, Gorbachev said, when they say that totalitarianism was initially embedded in the October Revolution, I can't agree with this. The ideas of the October Revolution, as a people's revolution, reflecting the real needs of the country, proclaiming the humane goals of freedom and democracy, carrying within itself the potential to solve the historical task of overcoming the separation of people from power, culture, and property. Well, these ideas have not lost their significance even today. And of course, like all of these guys, went on to condemn Stalin. But as I've said 1,000 times, Stalin's methods, ideology, was no different than Lenin or Trotsky. Again, Stalin just had a more industrialized economy and a far more advanced bureaucracy. When he began, actually within his speech making at the early years of Perestroika, I don't remember if this quote is from his book or not, but he said, "As far as intellectual influence is concerned, I drew a lot from the thoughts of the late Lenin. Turning to Lenin gave me great support from the point of view of developing a program. I looked to the socialist idea as one of the important components of the future humanistic society, a new civilization." This bizarre misunderstanding of the nature of the world, the nature of good and evil, the balance of power in history, this was a major role in the almost disappearance of Russia. These universal goals, the universal man, Adam Kadmon. The book I'm referring to is Perestroika, New Thinking for Our Country and the World. And that was a blueprint for what he imposed on the Soviet Union. You've got to remember, at the time, of course, in 85, 86, I was a kid. I was in a heavy metal band. I wasn't really... But when I went to college and this all this stuff came to fruition, it was a different story. People loved the idea that the Soviet Union was collapsing. In fact, at the time, being a teenager, I wasn't worried about what took over. The Gulag system is falling. I was reading so many conservative columnists at the time, long before the internet. Rush Limbaugh had just became prominent. I was listening to him. WABC, very different man than what he became later on. Bob Grant, people like that. The fact that this system was collapsing, you know, I wasn't really thinking in terms of anything that came after. But in that very same book, Gorbachev says, "The essence of Perestroika lies in the fact that it unites socialism with democracy and revives the Leninist concept of socialist construction, both in theory and in practice." And the problem with slogans like that is these terms are so vague, there's nothing to refute. Gorbachev thought that the Cold War began because of the aggression of Stalinist USSR and later dictators. And once you renounce that kind of aggression, the universal family would accept their enemy with open arms. He believed in this humanistic civilization with a world government, which he said over and over again. Andrei Sakharov was saying this over and over again. In fact, Sakharov's book was refuted by Solzhenitsyn. That's where that essay came from that I quoted from the beginning. The shining temple on a green hill. This was the new globalist order. The builders now are gathering stones for its construction. Of course, a lot of this is very Masonic. And he was writing about this at the time. People like Soloviev, a contemporary of these events, not the Soloviev, he made it very clear. He said, "Such thoughts were born in Gorbachev not by virtue of any formal involvement in the Masonic order, but thanks to their perception from communication with foreigners, and not without the involvement of his own advisors who understood exactly what these words meant." Technically, Masonry was forbidden in the USSR. The Soviets had gone way beyond the 33rd degree. 33rd degree, I mean, that was, 18th century. But still, the Communist Party didn't consider Freemasons enemies, just irrelevant. The issue is not understanding the nature of evil. In clearing the field, in eliminating one authority, something else has to fill that gap. There are no vacuums in politics or anything else. Gorbachev's slogan, "More socialism, more democracy," this concept of the convergence of the two systems, which the left and the regime was screaming about at the time, that this is the future of the world. Gorbachev, it was said by many of his contemporaries and people who knew him well, that he had a tremendous inferiority complex. The way he spoke to Western leaders, that, you know, Russians in the embassies need to learn civilized norms. Don't act like you always do. This is what Gorbachev said in his acceptance speech when he received the Nobel Prize. A period of transition to a new quality in all areas of society's life is accompanied by painful phenomena. But we are initiating perestroika, we failed to properly assess and foresee everything. Our society turned out to be hard to move off the ground, not ready for major changes which affect people's vital interests and make them leave behind everything to which they had become accustomed over many years. In the beginning, we imprudently generated great expectations without taking into account the fact that it takes time for people to realize that all have to live and work differently to stop expecting that new life somehow will be given from above. I think it's way too much to ask given the time period. But this catastrophe, which almost saw the liquidation of Russia, required both the active suppression of evil, as Nazarov would say, as well as the affirmation of the true principles of politics in the state. But very few people understood it at the time. That's the problem with the National Bolsheviks, or the so-called Red Patriots. Alexander Zinoviev, one of them, said, "The crisis that had matured in the Soviet Union could have been overcome by the means of this society as a communist society. No special restructuring of the foundations of society were required." So you had this false dichotomy of essentially liberals, free marketeers, Jews on the one side, and if some of you were alive at the time, the conservatives. And the media loved using that word to refer to the Communist Party faithful. Of course, there was a Russian party, as Nazarov likes to talk about, a Russian nationalist and Orthodox party. And it was necessary that a state religious and patriotic ideology was absolutely essential. I mean, they did some good work, you know, even works by the immigration, even pre-revolutionary authors began to appear in Russian journals. Legitimate patriotic cultural and social events multiplied all over the place, unions, fraternities, but it never coalesced as a true opposition party. Do you guys remember Pamyat or Pamyat? That was one of the first, at least that I ever heard of, during the perestroika years. It was headed by Dmitry Vasilev, who I think I had an email conversation with once, billion years ago. It came from the Orthodox Black Hundred wing of the Russian party, and in and of itself was perfectly acceptable ideologically. It was a fairly small organization, but there were certain things that got me suspicious, only later on. The head of the security service under President Yeltsin, Khrushchev, and his employee, his underling, Vladimir Strelitsky, who was the, and not to mention Pavel Khlebnikov, the senior, one of the editors at Forbes, using all of this, all this information, Forbes ended up writing, "Pamyat was born with the help of the KGB. The idea was to somehow structure the feelings of the Russian people and give them a political tint, thereby frightening public opinion in the West and forcing them to help moderate Gorbachev as the only alternative to the forces of extremism." If you've listened to my work or read my work on that idiot buffoon Vladimir Zhirinovsky, he was used in the same way. There were plenty of people in Russia at the time who were aware that Pamyat had KGB ties. But it's more than just ties. We know this because Pamyat eventually said that they need to close ranks around the Central Committee of the Communist Party headed by Gorbachev, which doesn't make any sense from their point of view. The KGB was pretty good at this. It was to lead and control the organizational development of real grassroots Russian nationalism, to direct its path and development along a way that's less dangerous for the regime. to compromise it. What Zhirinovsky used to do, whenever someone like Yeltsin would lose popularity and disappear for weeks, and people started rejecting the so-called shock therapy, he would show up and, I don't know, slap a woman in the face or say he's going to nuke Lithuania. He said this crap all the time. Of course, he was a Jewish liberal. That's why his party was named the Liberal Democratic Party initially, many years ago. He eventually was drafted to be used as this caricature, this mockery of a nationalist. There's another member of Pamyat, Smirnov Osashvili. Now, I don't particularly remember this, but in January of 1990, he staged what he called a Jewish pogrom, the House of Writers. It was the most idiotic thing in the world. Essentially, it was a one-man riot. He threw books around. He broke the glasses of Anatoly Kurchatkin. Of course, it was all captured on video in advance. Ostavili was arrested and sentenced to 2 years. And then he hanged himself in the camps where he was sent. The other thing was these black shirt actions. The march of a group in black uniform along Arbat, the street in the heart of Moscow, in front of all these foreign tourists. And of course, the leftist media, the Western media, was invited in advance. Well, that's pretty much what Pomkin did, and it collapsed right afterward. Clearly, when someone did this kind of nonsense, any decent person is going to leave. But for these Russia specialists in America, it became the Pomyat back then became the convenient boogeyman of Russian fascism. There even was a story in, I think it was 1990, that pogroms were being prepared for the 1000th anniversary of the baptism of Rus. And Vasiliev, the head of Pomyat, wasn't shy about this. He willingly gave interviews to Western journalists. He called himself an Orthodox fascist. Ligachev in the Politburo, he says, was his patron. There was a case of the Jew Arkady Norinsky. Around this time, he was distributing leaflets throughout Moscow, threatening reprisals against Jews in the name of Pomyat. Of course, Jewish media editors disseminated these on an all-union scale. They even had precise dates for the pogroms that are coming for the 1000th anniversary. Well, Norinsky was, of course, you know, what you doing, Rabbi? It is true, however, that people like Yakovlev realized that a true Orthodox patriotic ideology was their worst nightmare, and it certainly interfered with their plans for the country more than the dying Communist Party. Gorbachev found himself captivated by the praise of others. And this is where the oligarchs took advantage, simply pushed the country in their direction, which was already falling. Gorbachev naively called for the, quote, placing universal moral and ethical standards as a basis for international policy. You know, really stupid things like that, almost designed for applause more than anything else. If you remember, I talked about the article, Russophobia, a few months ago. And I mentioned Anatoly Yanov, who's a Jewish and hence anti-Russian writer at the time. And of course, he's active in this period of time. And here's what he said. The revival of Russian imperial nationalism is 100 times more dangerous than Soviet adventures in Africa. If over the last half millennium, there was a moment when the West vitally needed a precise, thoughtful, and powerful strategy capable of influencing Russia's historical choice, then this moment has arrived now in the nuclear age, in the face of its Russia's national crisis unfolding before our eyes. Well, the U.S. was attempting to control Russia's historical choice. And one of the ways it did it, with the help of Western academics, is the denigration of Russian history. And far worse, the encouragement of anti-Russian separatism in the national republics. republic slaved by Russian communism, as they would call it. In September of 1990 in Rome, the U.S. helped finance this. It was a conference of emigre figures, as well as, you know, Russian writers. The national question in the USSR. This is part of their appeal. We, the intelligentsia, must find in ourselves sufficient foresight. The existence of one of the greatest empires in the history of mankind is ending, and a new state formation is emerging on its territory. The process is already irreversible. Today, we could not talk about its prevention, but only about a legal, democratic, and humane solution to the conflicts that arise in its course. And of course, the main argument was the imperial exploitation by Moscow. This Russophobia, which had been financed by the West for many decades. There was an increasing call for Russian separatism itself. Russia fed all of these republics. Russia educated all of these republics, for better or for worse. Although I find it odd that you have to call, they call themselves the intelligentsia. Who calls themselves an intellectual? You get called that. Now there was one force left. Just like the anti-monarchist socialists in 1917, the one force that could have fought back, the army. They needed a kind of 1905 scenario, the so-called Bloody Sunday. And the pattern is very clear. You organize a peaceful demonstration. You make sure that there are provocateurs in it that escalate tensions. They commit acts of vandalism or aggression against law enforcement or whatever. And then, of course, that provokes the violent suppression of the demonstration. With a compliant media, you could push this however you want. It happened in December in 86 in Amaat, and especially it occurred in 88 and 89 in the Armenian Azerbaijani situation, Tbilisi in January of 1990. And, of course, the infamous TV tower, the January events in Vilnius. The Soviet troops were allegedly shooting at a separatist gathering. They declared their independence at this point. The Vilnius clash was, of course, completely staged. The expert examination initially established. The people were killed by shots from the TV tower using weapons that the Soviet paratroopers never used. But of course, the Lithuanian government didn't want to accept this. Now, the leader of the Lithuanian fighters, who became the Minister of Defense of Lithuania, Butkevičius or something, he admitted personally that he planned the victims at the Vilnius TV tower in advance and very successfully placed snipers on the roofs of the buildings who fired into the crowd to stir up passions and compromise the Czechist paratroopers sent by Moscow to control the situation. This was their version of the Tiananmen Square mythology. In fact, there's even a picture of a man standing in front of a column of Soviet tanks, forcing it to stop. And worse, a few Soviet soldiers were sent to prison for this, despite them not being guilty at all. But none of this was anti-communist. None of this was anti-Marxist. None of this was anti-socialist. No, what Radio Liberty said, the infamous radio station, what they said was that all communist crimes in the 20th century to be blamed on traditional imperial great power ambitions, that is to say, of the Russian population. Radio Liberty was a disaster from 1988 to 1990. There's so many examples. In one broadcast, it was said that the one-party system, which is a party, a monarchy, and the conditions of the 20th century, totalitarianism have in common an imperial structure. Probably, in Russia, another structure is impossible. Here it is always on bones and blood, and the Russian people are incapable of doing good. There were so many of these broadcasts. And a massive campaign against Orthodox patriots who sought to return Russia to its historical path. I think it was Vladimir Malenkovich working for the same station, said, the country they, and we're talking about the village prose writers, the Russian agrarians, the country they represent is not Russia at all. This country is called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Half of the population of this country is non-Russian. And to talk about Russian patriotism in such a country is simply shameless and immoral. Their main ideologist was a guy named Boris Paramanov, who went so far as to say that the village prose writers, if they were to take over, it would lead to genocide, like in Cambodia. Paramanov was a vicious human being. And he talked about just, you know, well, let me quote him here directly. And this is right on Radio Liberty, financed by the CIA. It's necessary to knock the Russian person out of tradition. You are talking about the non-secularization of the Russian consciousness as a source of danger. But Perestroika must not only dismantle what is called totalitarian socialism, but also change the spiritual structure of the Russian person, bring it closer to a Western mindset. A mutation of the Russian spirit must occur to a new type of morality on the solid ground of enlightened, egoistic self-interest. I like that the call sign of Radio Liberty was taken from the melody of the anthem of the Masonic Provisional Government, 1917. So this is the official statement of the U.S. government here. Marxism wasn't a problem. Marxists were ruling Western societies in the sense that they took over universities. None of their stuff was ever prescribed, unlike the National Socialist stuff. Marxism was a legitimate approach to the world. Thousands of university professors, the crimes of the Marxists of the 60s and 70s in the West were always covered up. There's so many. And I could go on and on and on about this. The Democratic Union, was his name, Vladimir Novodorsky. And he comes out and talks about, you know, the destruction of Russia as such. And these were all people promoted, broadcast by, collaborating with Radio Liberty. Again, this is an official part of the U.S. government. And of course, they, when they talk about, you know, democratization or individualism, they're only talking about the Russian people. Trying to get them as denationalized as humanly possible. You know, to have a McDonald's open up in a country, you know, Greece years ago didn't know heart problems. It was very rare for Greeks 100 years ago to have heart attacks. It's because of their diet, their heavy fish diet. The minute Western food came in, all of a sudden, you have clogged arteries. I loved it when, during you know the sanctions and McDonald's left Russia and Pornhub didn't want to broadcast. I said, "Oh, how will Russian culture ever survive? These are great things." The golden arches were a symbol for American control, but at the time, it was also taken as a symbol for what they thought liberation was. But Yakovlev, as I guess the main ideologist under Gorbachev, the cooperation among Western ideological leaders and their special services, along with Soviet Westernizers, as well as a Jewish mafia. Yeah, they were called tycoons or businessmen. Took place at every level, fighting against, quote, party conservatives. The head of KGB, a foreign intelligence, between 89 and 91 was Sibarashin. He reported that there was a strong presence of CIA men in the Soviet upper echelons. The chairman of the KGB overall, Khrushchev, reported this to Gorbachev, and Gorbachev covered up for these suspects and informed them about it. Kovalev the same way. Khrushchev then said, closed meeting, the Supreme Soviet, that our country will cease to exist if these CIA agents of influence aren't neutralized. But with that kind of leadership, nothing was ever done, obviously. The Jewish question was well known. but given American support for the liberal movement, there was no talking about it. The Russian party, the Orthodox party, couldn't hope for any help from the party cadres, no matter how much they hated Western capitalism and McDonald's. Semenov is talking about Igor Ligachev, about some of the protests. He says this, and this is in 91, Russian patriots had many media outlets at the time, including in part television and radio broadcasting. Their rallies and meetings were attended by packed halls and stadiums. Outside of Moscow and Leningrad, the liberal forces were clearly weak. The army and state security were literally seething with indignation and thirsting for action. The betrayal of the ruling elite, headed by Gorbachev, the wretchedness of the leaders of the notorious State Emergency Committee, decided the matter easily and simply, as if on an operetta stage. Now, I have a whole separate article and a separate a lecture on the Emergency Committee, or the very pathetic coup attempt. But the Semenov goes so far as to try to compare the hardliners of the Communist Party with Tsar Nicholas. And there is no comparison, because the Tsar categorically refused to cooperate with the forces of evil and was betrayed by everyone, his generals, media, other members of the dynasty. Gorbachev was the exact opposite. He cooperated with the forces of evil and thereby destroyed everything around him. No one in the top leadership of the party, despite their being aware of what the West really was, there was no one who understood the spiritual problems of what was going on. The communists versus Democrats nonsense. The Russian Orthodox Party didn't make enough effort to take advantage of freedoms from perestroika, to form itself as something independent of the party. The party could never be your friend. There were, you know, the national Bolsheviks within the party, some of them were even Orthodox. That offered pretty much an easy solution, working within the party apparatus, but it didn't go anywhere. It was the main reason for this true Orthodox faction, the Orthodox Russian party, to influence anything. I mean, those people who consider the Red Army to be the Russian army and Stalin to be the national leader, these are not the people who are capable of saving Russia at all. And unfortunately, and I say this heavily, gravely, a huge reason why the Russian National Party failed in this era is that they got zero support from the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate. You see, the opposite was going on, the Catholics in Poland. Very different story. But the main enemy, the rising Judaic oligarchy, of course played a massive role in these events. Gorbachev, his inferiority complex, had this passion to please these circles, trying to be the most progressive voice out there. As communism was falling apart, the Jewish forces were manifesting. Once they were released from prison, if you read Friedman's book, Red Mafia, the Israelis were angry that all these Jews didn't want to go to Israel. They wanted to go to New York. It turned out happening. It turns out that the united efforts of these Jewish dissidents, the Jewish nomenklatura members, Jewish black market gangs, and foreign Jewish capitalists became a single front of struggle against whatever got in their way. And don't forget, Mossad, CIA were operating on a large scale in the Soviet Union. There was no opposition, really, from the KGB. They had 500,000 full-time employees, at least on the books. Anatoly Korolev talked about the subversive activities of agents of the Israeli Special Services and its allies from among persons of Jewish nationality. That was the Israeli line as part of the second KGB service for Moscow and the Moscow region. He was aware of their subversion and what he said, he said, well, Israeli intelligence is the best intelligence service in the world. And it's not just because Jews live all over the world, some of whom share the idea of dual citizenship, to a large extent due to the unusual forms and methods of intelligence activity. We were mainly engaged in useless paperwork, despite the fact that the central office, we had some data on the work of Israeli intelligence agents in our country. This information was not, in the eyes of the authorities, a sufficient basis for conducting appropriate counterintelligence actions. Korolev had all of these, you know, there were lots of people in the KGB who had all these proposals to increase and improve their effectiveness. But Korolev, in his book, says that his superior said, you don't know anything about intelligence, espionage, counterintelligence, or Zionism. Stop coming up with initiatives. I forbid you and your subordinates to read books on the topic, to analyze materials in this area. They're generals for this. They get paid for it. People like Sharansky, Anatoly Sharansky, one of the founders of the Helsinki group, the liberal group, was convicted of espionage. KGB was forbidden to detain him. He kept lists of hundreds of restricted enterprises, all kinds of illegal products and stuff. Why did the leadership obstruct the measures to increase counterintelligence activities that our group proposed, he says. Some people thought about the possible involvement of some KGB leaders, members of the party, Politburo, and the Israeli agencies. Many KGB leaders are married to Jewish women. There are many Jews among KGB employees. Eventually, he was sentenced to prison. And this was in 1977. He was exchanged for a Soviet agent arrested in the U.S. Keep in mind something else. Gorbachev reshuffled his personnel worse than anybody else. Purge after purge after purge after purge. He didn't trust anybody. In order to overcome any the resistance that, you know, of the system, either good or bad, Gorbachev subjected the entire apparatus, the entire state, to continuous purges. One of the most important internal aspects of perestroika, in fact. 1985 to 1990, 5 years, 85% of the Central Committee members were replaced, which is far more than even Stalin's purges in the 30s. The Congress of People's Deputies, the interregional deputy group of Democrats, was formed, headed by the former candidate for membership in the Politburo Central Committee, Boris Yeltsin. Having lost that competition within the party to Gorbachev in 1987, Yeltsin then got angry. He handed in his party card in 1990 and was elected as a deputy as a fighter against the privileges of the party apparatus. Gorbachev then removed Article 6 in the Constitution, which was the dominant role of the Communist Party. But that means he had to create a new form of legitimacy. It has to be more acceptable to the West. He became president of the USSR, even while remaining general secretary. There was capitulation all over the place. The Baltic Republics, as I mentioned before, in the TV Tower issue. The Baltics declared independence. Gorbachev didn't recognize it. During a meeting with President Bush in Malta in 89, you know, Eastern Europe was already, you know, falling. Gorbachev said only democratic methods, never force, would be used. And he also let the Baltic separatists know about this. But even in 86, the Reykjavik summit, the Chernobyl issue that very same year. Now, we've talked about it on this show. We know it's a wild exaggeration, but the regime loved it. And even David Rockefeller was invited to the Central Committee chambers. They wanted a time frame for the, I'll quote him directly, a time frame for the implementation of perestroika. When will it be possible to raise the question of the organic inclusion of the Soviet economy in the world? Now, if you listen to me for a long time, you know how to unpack that. Organic inclusion. That just means to be submissive to the immutable world laws that were developed by the newly forming regime and the oligarchy. Integration is just a code word for taking over their dying economy. Dobrynin, experienced diplomat, who wrote about Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, his foreign minister, A lot of secret agreements with the U.S. Here's what he says about it. Gorbachev began to improvise, and without consulting the Politburo and experts, he agreed to sudden compromises, which in a number of cases could not be regarded as anything other than unilateral concessions. Self-confident in their infallibility and praised by the media, Gorbachev and Shevardnadze did not receive an adequate equivalent, not only in the area of disarmament, but also in such important issues as the unification of Germany and pan-European security. Shevardnadze, completely bizarre, without any reason or benefit to the country, ceded to the United States huge territories on the Russian shelf in the Bering Sea. In November of 1990, the Paris Charter was signed. The so-called Velvet Revolutions and the Warsaw Pact were legalized. In fact, that may well be the day that the Cold War ended. And of course, it wasn't until April of 91 that the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. Which normally, you know, this is what Russian patriots have been fighting for years, to destroy this system. But there's a lot of problems. Not only what's going to replace it, but what have they done to the population? What kind of personality do you have growing up in that system? Enforced atheism, enforced materialism, enforced feminism, all this crap. Prison sentences. You know, what raw material, personal raw material do you have? Gorbachev's vanity played a massive role in these concessions. The Peace Prize alone for ending the Cold War. He got the Grand Cross for the unification from Germany from the hands of the Chancellor. But still, regardless of all this, the American actions to create these separatist movements in the former USSR, of course, still going on today, although for a different reason. But by 1990, Yeltsin was elected chairman of the Supreme Soviet of the Russian Republic. June 12th, the state sovereignty of the Russian Republic was proclaimed. Russian laws over Soviet laws. Yeltsin said, as soon as the word sovereignty was heard, the clock of history began to tick. The last hour of the Soviet Empire had struck. And as all of you know, the parade or the chain of sovereignties at the time, ethnic groups that no one's ever heard of before, like the Komi or the Udmurt or the Karelian, created their own states. I remember the cartoons at the time. And of course, he very quickly signed an agreement with the Baltic republics, recognizing them as subjects of international law, despite having very large Russian minorities living within them. However, March 1991, there was a referendum. This was a question. Do you consider it necessary to preserve the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics as a renewed federation of equal sovereign republics? Now, Yeltsin, the U.S., they were propagandizing all over the place for a no vote. The U.S. was promising people the moon if the vote went its way. You had a turnout of 80%. Now, in certain places, going to the polls for that referendum was forbidden. It was very odd for a new liberal democratic country to do. In fact, it was forbidden in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Moldova, Armenia, and Georgia. Although there were parts of it, like Abkhazia, that created their own commission, electoral commissions. And they voted 98.6% to preserve it. All told, 76.4% were in favor of preserving the USSR, as that union, as the question said. Russia was 71%, Ukraine 70%, which is interesting. Belarus 82%. Tajikistan, Turkmenistan almost 100%. Same thing for Central Asia was always very loyal, for better or for worse. Azerbaijan, 93.3% to remain in the USSR. Same thing for Uzbekistan, 93.7%. But that Ukraine, 70.2% wanted to remain in a renewed USSR. This is what caused the U.S. to shift its support from Gorbachev to Yeltsin. And what occurred in the 1990s, well, we all know. Upon taking power, his Jewish reformers, including in places like Harvard as well as in Russia, they gained huge fortunes of state property, using their positions in the government to become, they became oligarchs. There was no establishment of any new legal structure of the market. You know, things like private property or overseeing financial markets or enforcing contracts or taxation. There's no way they could have been that stupid. They knew what was going to happen. But I started off this talk talking about how idiotic Western intellectuals are. And I distinctly remember this at the time, because there were plenty of conservatives that were talking about this like it was a good thing. And again, we all loved the idea that the Soviet Union was disappearing. It was only Solzhenitsyn who was saying, wait a minute, this is a huge problem. Western economists especially said that you just dismantle the command economy. It's going to raise GDP and living standards because resources will be allocated more efficiently. Any kind of restructuring will create new production possibilities. A market system will make sure it works. There won't be any of these macroeconomic distortions anymore. There'll be all kinds of incentives. But they assumed that vacuums exist. Mass poverty, unemployment, plummeting life expectancy. The GDP lost more than half of its value in a year. Stephen Rosefield, in 2001, published a study where he calculated that there were 3.4 million premature deaths in Russia, just Russia, from 1990 to 1998. Premature deaths. Specifically, they could be blamed on the shock therapy that came with the Washington Consensus. I started off with the Solzhenitsyn quote. I'll end it with the Solzhenitsyn quote. The universal suppression of thought leads not to its extinction, but to distortion, ignorance, mutual incomprehension of compatriots and contemporaries. This is why Solzhenitsyn said, you need to maintain the old Soviet symbols and institutions at least for a while before you can create a new legal system. Well, the solution to the problem was China. That's why the Tiananmen Square nonsense all came about. China solved the problem. Of course, Russia solved the problem with Putin, although it was, 10 years later. Ukraine is still now fourth world. Belarus, of course, thank God for Lukashenko. There are a few places that were saved from this absolute destruction. Ukraine is the most tragic. But Solzhenitsyn is talking about what happens when you live in a totalitarian system with all the threats and all the problems that you have. A lot of us are living under the same system now. We're all opposition, especially in the EU, where all opposition figures are going to prison. The suppression of thought leads not to its going away, but to distortion, ignorance, incomprehension. A lot of what I said here is not available to scholars in Russian history. They have no access to it. Even if they did, they'd be terrified to talk about it. Therefore, huge variables, huge factors, and all of these movements are not allowed to talk about. It's ridiculous. What they write is useless. Anyway, that's the end of part two, and we are finished with this. We'll go to another topic next week, and as always, I appreciate you listening. Bye-bye.